tonight on Arena. They're in the Grefa on her new poetry collection, To Star the Dark, and Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Teresi on their new album, They're Calling Me Home. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. To Star the Dark is the seventh poetry collection from Dirin Ní Gréifhe, a writer who has won many awards, among them the Rooney Prize for Literature and a Lannan Literary Fellowship. She wrote the new poetry side by side with A Ghost in the Throat, the extraordinary prose work published in 2020, which explored Dirin's own creative and domestic life in tandem with the life and poetry of Eileen Dubh Ní Chonaill of Queen Arthur Lyra fame. There are, Dirin tells us, secret trapdoors between the two books. I'm delighted to have Dirin Ní Gréifhe join me on the line right now. Let's start with one of those trapdoors, if we can, Dirin. At Derry Nan, I think of Eileen Dubh again.
Yeah, it's funny. The fact that I composed both of these books side by side, as you said, means that there are these kind of secret tunnels and trapdoors between both books. So anyone who's read A Ghost in the Throat will notice different insights, I suppose, into some of the subjects that were explored there. And this poem, more than any other one, I returned to Eileen Dubh Ní Chonaill. And there was actually also another poem in homage to her, in respect to her, I suppose, in my first book, Clasped, as well. So this one is called At Derry Nan, I Think of Eileen Dubh Again. In April, when bog myrtle flickers through thickets, and crimson stems begin to sink in catkins again, stretching to a length that might tickle a girl's knees, a girl who laughs as she hurries through trees. I'm reading your words, Mahara is mooing to, and wondering again where they buried you. If I could find your gravestone, I'd bring no rose, Eileen, only a fistful of myrtle stems tied in twine, tugged tight and neat, to be placed gently at your feet.
Dirin Ní Gréifhe with her poem there at Derry Nan, I Think of Eileen Dubh Again, and that's from her new poetry collection, To Star the Dark. The problem with these secret trapdoors, Dirin, is it means I don't have an opening question which says, so you've abandoned the prose altogether now and it's back to the poetry. the two are in tandem all the time.
They really are. And I mean, for better or worse, what I'm learning is that's the kind of writer I am. I often have several books at different stages of completion on my chaotic desk, such as it is. And I'm writing prose and poetry at the same time. I'm writing in Irish and English at the same time. I'm all over the place, Sean.
Yeah, and we have the Cúpla Focail in that poem as well. We hear that little section from, is that from Queen Arthur Leary, Macara is my own too?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and it's funny, you know, I don't think the presence of Eileen Dubh Ní Chonaill will ever leave me now. I'm starting to suspect that she'll make herself felt in all of my books.
And would it be common in the same respect as that, Dirin, that you might be dealing with the same topics across your various parts of your writing, the same themes?
I suppose to a certain extent, because I'm the type of writer where a lot of my poems and a lot of my writing is sparked from incidents in my own life. So I suppose it leads from that there's a certain amount of common ground between these two books, you know. But it's interesting the different ways in which certain events make themselves manifest between the poems and the prose, you know.
Yeah, I was really interested in a section within To Star the Dark called Seven Postcards from Hospital. Mm-hmm. Short prose poems, all of them dealing with the same birth experience, yeah?
Yes, yeah. It's I suppose there are certain mysteries to a life in writing, Sean. And when my youngest child was born, it was a traumatic birth, and she ended up being in neonatal ICU for a little while. And the way, to a certain extent, that I coped with the trauma of that experience, which so many people have gone through, was to write these little postcards, as I called them, to my very close friend, Sarah Baum, and emailed them to her. And that, in some way, helped me in the fear of those days and those weeks to have this kind of almost sense of distancing that came from composing a line or two. And these postcards are only maybe two or three lines long often.
Yeah, but that suggests to me that as you were recovering after that quite traumatic birth experience, that you were writing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was writing. And actually, it's funny, like it was a birth by cesarean section. And even while the spinal morphine was still in my system, there's another one of the poems in the book that I composed while I was still recovering from that. And that's a very strange poem. But yeah, I tend to write as things are happening, and for some reason that helps me, particularly through difficult moments.
Yeah, because the specifics of the one you're talking about, while you were effectively the effects of the anaesthetic were still there, you're talking about not knowing whether you're going to be able to walk across the ward. You know, it's that immediate, the response. So that's a very present moment, if you like. But the Eileen Dove aspect seems like an element of the past slipping in. Also, the title of the collection, To Star the Dark, comes from the poem Brightening. You're writing about a fire in Cork. You've written about fires in Cork quite a lot. Were there a lot of fires in Cork? Or is it just something about that? Is it something about that particular type of event that interests you?
Yeah, I'm very interested in fire. All right. I suppose like you bring a lot of things back to your childhood, and we tended to have quite a few chimney fires when I was small. So I suppose when you're a little girl looking at that kind of thing, it becomes a source of fascination. And like I've lived in Cork for over half my life now, attending to the sense of history that's, you can't avoid it in a place like this. And it really, like we'd say in Irish painting, Gomorrah Vimeorm, it really affects me and influences me in very ordinary ways, but also makes itself felt, that sense of the past, in everything I write. And yeah, Cork has burned down many, many times.
And survived being burned down in your poetry many times as well.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Between Nectarines, that poem, if you would, there, and read it for us.
Yeah. So I suppose this poem is a good example of the ways we find ourselves wedged between the present and the past and the future, and how sometimes we might feel ourselves almost to be kind of like vehicles between one generation and the next, with certain traits and thoughts and appetites moving through us from ancestors to descendants. And I suppose on a much simpler level, pregnancy cravings are very weird, the way they rush up and grab a hold of you. And I often asked myself, where on earth these powerful urges were coming from? So this poem is called Between Nectarines. All winter, the infant inside me dreams of nectarines. She thirsts for their dimpled clefts, blushing skins, sweet, torn flesh. With each urge, I think of my grandmother's mother, a stranger, girl who crossed an ocean to scour bedpans and polish brass, who returned wrapped in old red skirts and a new cloche hat, dreaming all her lost fruits back. Not our crab apples or blackberries. No, she spoke of blueberries and nectarines, of mangoes. I stand between them when my teeth touch the husk. Hardy cargo, clenched between future and past, and within a small seed. All winter she dreams.
Between Nectarines there, another of the poems from Dearden the Agriophus, To Star in the Dark. Extraordinary to be dreaming of nectarines and mangoes in Ireland. No matter what part of the country you're in, you'll have a hard job finding either of those, I would have thought. And this is...
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that story. My grandmother's mother really did spend some time in America and come back. Ah. And the different flavours that she would have encountered over there, it intrigues me to imagine what she must have seen.
Yeah, and obviously, because I was wondering where did those thoughts come into her mind, but that's obviously what it is. She still had that trip in her mind, that move to America and the move back home again.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Tell me a little bit about the cover illustration. It's very powerful the way it looks at you. Maybe you would describe it to me, Dearden, and why you chose this.
Yes, that's one of the amazing gifts of publishing in poetry, is that oftentimes publishers allow you to choose your own cover art, which is something that I really, really love. And I find that I can't even talk about this book, Sean, without this weird story about the cover. It's a painting by Tom Clement, who's an extraordinarily talented artist. And it hung for many, many years in a restaurant in Ennis. It's a huge canvas in which a woman kind of, she's looking back at us, but her face is empty or erased, or the features of it aren't quite distinct. And then whenever I look at it, I feel as though she's lost in thought. And every time I pass the window of that restaurant where she was hanging there, I ducked my head to salute her. And then one day when I was passing, the painting was gone. So I went in and asked the waiters, but they didn't know where she had disappeared to. And they probably thought I was a bit mad, to be honest as well. But one happy day, months later, I managed to find the painting in the hotel next door, where it was keeping watch over the ladies' toilets of all places. And I found the artist, Tom Clement, and asked if I could use it as book cover. And I was so, so delighted when he agreed. And my son was there when I got the email back from him and asked why I was so happy. And I showed him a picture of the painting on my phone and said that someday it would be the cover of my future book. And he replied, "Oh, so that's why it looks so familiar." And there was something about him saying that that really got me. And I just had goosebumps because imagine seeing something that is yet to be, and at the same time, it feels familiar. And I think it speaks to a lot of what I was trying to communicate in the poems of this book, the feeling of the past, the future, and how strange it is to be caught between the two.
And come here now, does that mean that every time you see this book in a shop window, or indeed on somebody's bookshelf, that you'll do a little genuflection or a little nod going past the front cover of the book?
I don't think there could be a better cover for this book. It is just, and I'm delighted with it.
Yeah, and you can say to people, no, it's not my book that I'm genuflecting in front of. It's the cover illustration that's causing my genuflection. Words, obviously, it's hardly surprising that words would be important to a poet. Tell us a little bit about the poem. I'm saying craquelure. Is that the right way to say this word?
I mean, I think so, but so much of my own curiosity comes through in the poems, and so much of that curiosity is sparked by my own reading. So oftentimes I'll come across a new word and I'll become kind of obsessed with it. But because I've only ever encountered it written down, Sean, I'm like you, I'm taking a stab at how it's pronounced. I would say craquelure. So I think you're right, but I'm not sure. And I suppose from the first moment I came across that word, craquelure, I was kind of obsessed with this because I hadn't known that it means all those tiny little cracks that you sometimes see on the surface of oil paintings. And for me, as quite a clumsy person, that pattern immediately brings to mind something completely different, which is a smashed phone screen, something that happens to me horribly often. And how often when we have the habit of storing photos of people we love as our screensavers, if you drop your phone, you'll often see this kind of craquelure appear over their faces. So the poem that I wrote, Craquelure, speaks to that, the dropped phone, and what it says about the present and the past. Craquelure. Her tracksuit is pink velour, her earlobes prettily golden hooped, and she shivers, as we all do, in this bus queue. At 5:56, some glitch, some distraction, some finger twitch slips the phone from her grip and sends it smashing into the pavement. We all flinch. Soon the bus moves us through streets and suburbs and into the dark. Night makes a mirror of the window and makes me a spy. Sitting behind, I watch her fingers move fast on that fractured glass, where digits progress still over her child's smile, his eyes grown suddenly lined. A little ink leaks from those rifts and it grows dark. Oh, it grows dark and darker. Take us back, driver. Lurch this bus into reverse. As a conservator rewinds a painting's eyes, bring us back. Let her lift her phone from the path intact. Let her shiver, check the time, sigh at her child's smile, then slide the phone back in her pocket, its digits slipping to 5:59.
You make the cracking of a phone sound so romantic and so poetic. Thanks so much, Dairn. Great to speak with you this evening. Congratulations on the collection.
Thank you, Sean.
That's Dairn Ní Graifeá, and her new collection, To Star the Dark, is published by Daedalus Press. The career of Rhiannon Giddens began when she studied opera at the Oberlin Conservatory of Music in Ohio. But she subsequently achieved enormous success with very different musical adventure, the Grammy Award-winning country blues band Carolina Chocolate Drops. In recent years, she and her partner, Francesco Torrisi, have taken a new direction in this fascinating musical journey, earning another Grammy Award for them and leaving one magazine to comment, "There are few artists so fearless and so ravenous in their exploration." That description certainly applies to the latest album from Rhiannon and Francesco. It's called They're Calling Me Home. Country, bluegrass, traditional Irish, opera and old Italian folk melodies. They're all there. There's more as well, however they manage that. I'll be talking to Rhiannon and Francesco in a few moments' time. But first of all, let's hear little bit of the opening and title track from the album.
I know you remember me when I'm gone. Remember my stories, remember my songs. I'll leave them on earth, sweet traces of gold.
Little flavour there of the opening track, Calling Me Home, from the new album from Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Torrisi. And the album is called They're Calling Me Home. We reviewed it a while back here on the programme. And to say that our reviewers were positive about it is a gross understatement. Everybody was jumping up and down with the delight. In fact, on the night I said, I really hope I get to talk about this album more. So I am absolutely delighted that Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Torrisi are talking with me about it this evening. Let's start with that opening song that we just heard, the opening section of, Rhiannon. Where does that song come from?
It's a song by Alice Gerard, who is a institution. She's been in the bluegrass and Americana world for a long time, and she lives in North Carolina, and she wrote it some years ago, and I just have always loved that song, but it's never been so insistent that it needed to be sung. It just kept tapping at the back of my brain, you know, in this last year, and it was bringing me such comfort to sing it and to play it with Francesco. I knew that we needed to, you know, we needed to record it.
Yeah, in some ways, the there are themes that are set out in that Calling Me Home song, you know, stories, remember my stories, sweet traces of gold that are found in songs. But it speaks in some ways, Rhiannon, and I'll stick with you on this one, directly to the situation we've all found ourselves in the last 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I was stuck in the song because of, you know, its relationship with death and how I think a healthy relationship is, you know, you get to the time that it's time to move on and you are, you know, ready to go and your family lets you go. And, you know, and that's how you kind of want it to be. But that's how it's not been for so many people who have been alone and we can't grieve together. And then there's all the separation from, you know, another kind of home, which is, you know, not even being able to visit maybe a birth home or to see family. And so it just recalled a lot of different aspects of homegoing for us.
And thematically, that song, Francesco, really sets up what we get across several of the songs on the album. You know, this longing for home, a sense of home, aspects of home seem to be present in many of the songs indeed. But what really struck me, and I presume you have a large part to play in how the musical side, the musical accompaniment of side of things, how that's arranged. There's a kind of a sparseness to it, but a very beautiful sparseness. I guess songs like Calling Me Home with that wail almost from somewhere primitive. They need to be, they don't need to be tampered with too much.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really know a lot of this material, you know, a lot of the songs that Rhiannon has known for a very long time, they were all new to me for sure. So that's an interesting part of the process, you know, of not having a preconceived idea what, you know, the song is supposed to sound like. But for that song in particular, I mean, to me, it just sounded like a drone song, you know. So there is very little more than just drones, like static notes, because I didn't want anything else to take away from the power of, you know, the singing and the lyrics for sure.
And what's providing the drone in that particular track, Francesco?
I'm playing accordion. It's a piano accordion, you know. There's a lot of different, you know, especially in Ireland, I think people laugh at piano accordions and it has such a bad rep. But you know, it's an instrument that has a huge range and a lot of variety of beautiful sounds. And then Rhiannon is playing octave viola on that too. So she's also droning herself and adding a sound that is slightly more, you know, alive in a different way than the drones of the accordion. So it's quite magical, I think, combination.
Francesco saying to us there, Rhiannon, about this, you know, you don't want to do too much with those songs. And he's done something with an accordion that certainly made it sound very different to me than I would normally necessarily or probably associate with the instrument. But you've done this across the album in the songs that you've chosen. I'm hearing songs from all sorts of places, all sorts of backgrounds, all sorts of traditions, but somehow there's a coherence across the 12 tracks on the album. When they could have just been, oh, here's a bluegrass song, here's a song with an Irish feel to it, here's a song that has, that's an Italian lullaby. How did you achieve the coherence, or was that, you know, did that just come out in the mix?
I think that's honestly part of the magic of the collaboration that Francesco and I have, is that, you know, like he mentioned, he hadn't heard a lot of these songs that I brought to the table. And I think both of us approach each other's sound worlds with that, you know, that kind of not having a preconceived notion and not having an expectation of what it should be. So I think we both can find what the song should be, and it's just, we support the song with our sounds and we let the song live. So I think that that makes it kind of, we find this the tie-in is us, you know, just letting the song live. And I think that's been one of the most, the things that I'm so appreciative about our musical partnership, is that we're able to meet in the middle in a way that serves the song the best.
Who brought Si Dolce El Tormento to the table then? Because obviously I mentioned your operatic background, but also there's an Italian aspect to this particular song. Who brought that one to the table, Francesco?
Well, it's a song that I've known for a very, very long time. I have a background in early music as well, so I've played that song and it's on my first piano album, you know, played in a different way. But I think we had performed it, we did a few shows last year, 2 years ago actually, just piano and voice, and we were performing that song because it's such a lovely kind of poppy song. It could have been written yesterday. But now the plan was actually not to record it in this session, and it came out at a moment where we were having a bit of a struggle with some of the material. We were a little stuck, like that can happen in any recording session. And Rhiannon said, hey, why don't we do Si Dolce Il Tormento? And on the cello banjo, you know, which is an instrument that I hadn't really an arrangement made for. And I was kind of kicking back and I said, no, this is for another project. I'm not sure I can put this together right now. But she convinced me to do it. And, you know, so I sat down for a minute and then we did it. And I'm so glad that she did, because I think it's one of the most powerful moments of the entire recording session.
It's very powerful on the album. Let's have a listen. I'm just going to come in straight into the vocal aspect of the song, a little bit into the piece. Si dolce il tormento.
Si dolce il tormento che in seno mi sta, che io vivo contento per cruda beltà, nel ciel di bellezza s'accresci fierezza e manchi pietà.
I'm presuming, Rhiannon, that Se Dolce El Tormento is something about how sweet is pain. Is that roughly what you're or she is singing, the character is singing about there?
Yeah, I mean, it's the torment of love unrequited, you know, there's that push me pull you thing where it's just like, oh, I want this so much and I can't have it, and it's just ripping me in pieces, and you know, there's a lot of tension in that, and I just connected to, you know, the beauty of Monteverdi's setting of those words. You know, there's just, he's just tapped into some really super deep feeling about love, which, you know, we all experience at one time or another.
And did Monteverdi include this as an opera, in an opera, or is it just a setting of a song, that music that he put to a poem or to to lyrics?
We'll have to ask Professor that now.
Yeah, Professor Francesco Teresi, you're on the spot.
Yeah, no, and this is not part of an opera. This is more of a light kind of canzonetta, they would have called them at the time, you know. It's more of a little light aria or something, you know, like a short piece that in fact probably wasn't meant to be such a serious, you know, intense piece. But at the same time, I think it transcends that idea, and it's such an incredible melancholic melody to it that I think goes further than the lyrics, almost, you know, that are quite stylized in a 17th century way.
Now, you rehabilitated the accordion in the first track that we listened to. I had spent a few hours today saying, what instrument is that that's accompanying Rhiannon in that song? I thought, oh, it's that classical guitar. And I went, no, maybe it's a lute, maybe it's some kind of early instrument. A cello banjo, you tell me.
Yes. Well, this is actually is an instrument that I play a lot on the record, but it's an instrument that Rhiannon has. It's an original Gibson 1920s cello banjo that I picked up when I was visiting her years ago, and I tried it, and it's strung with Nile guts, so imitation gut strings, you know. So for me, that was the appeal of it, is that it sounded like a lute, you know. It had this lutey sound. And I started messing with it, and I fell in love with it immediately. And I it's an instrument that I can't put down, you know. I want to play it all the time.
I didn't know why I bought it until he picked it up, because it was actually originally owned by Mike Seeger. And I knew Mike Seeger, and I was able to purchase a few of the instruments from his collection after he died, and that was one. And I was sitting with it going, this is beautiful, what am I going to do with this? And then he picked it up, and I was like, well, there you go.
I was going to ask, what type of music have you been playing on it? But clearly none until this moment in time. Francesco solved that problem for you. Let me just go straight into another track on the album, a little flavour of this.
Oh, death in the morning. Another year, death walked up to the sinner's door, said, now, sinner, you've got to go. The sinner looked around and began to cry, said, oh, no, death, I'm not ready to die. He's singing, no, oh, death. Oh, oh, death in the morning, oh.
Oh, Death, one of the songs on the new album from Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Teresi. The new album is called They're Calling Me Home. It's an absolutely amazing piece of work. We've had three tracks now, or a little flavour of three tracks, and, you know, it sounds like totally, totally different songs, totally different artists, totally different instruments. It's quite extraordinary how that happens across the album, and yet, as I say, it works as a unit as well. And the song that we heard, where does that come from, Rhiannon?
And that's an old Southern American song. It would have come to a lot of people's attention through Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah.
Where Ralph Stanley sang it. But I got my version from Bessie Jones, and it's more of a South Carolina, low country kind of, you know, more of an African-American, obviously, color to that. I loved her version of it. And I have to shout out to Ben Rollins, who was the engineer on the record. You know, he lives in near Dublin. And what he did with all the voices that I overlaid on that is just, it's really incredible. We couldn't have done, you know, what we did without him.
Yeah, well, you've answered my question then. Is that you doing all the backing vocals as well? They were overlaid by Ben.
Well, yeah. So we kind of worked together in that he made them sound so amazing. And what I did is I listened to, we tried to do as much performance like a performative recording as we could. So even when we did overdubs, we did them as performances. So I was performing with myself. Mm. And so I would do the whole pass, and then he knew when to pull him in and pull him out. But I was singing with myself the whole time, instead of sort of little bits and pieces where he has to put it all together. It's more like he gets to carve the cake, you know, that we've sort of baked. And it was a really great way of working.
That performative aspect, I'd say, is huge. It must be something you're missing enormously, Francesco. I'd love to see and hear the songs on this album performed live. You must be missing live performance.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, we haven't really been playing for well over a year now. And considering before we were on the road every month, you know, playing like, I don't know, 10, 15 shows, it's quite a huge contrast. And also, like, you know, being in Ireland somehow didn't really reopen ever. Like a lot of other places in Europe last year in the summer reopened a little bit. Ireland kind of reopened for 1 minute. Mm. We did two gigs in Skibbereen Arts Festival, and that was amazing in last summer, but that was it. So definitely, we're definitely missing, you know. And there's no stream or something we can do in that kind of format that can, you know, be the same as a live performance.
No, there's nothing to replace it. Francesco and Rhiannon, about your qualities on this album, but there are two other artists that come in at various points along the way that add hugely to the variety that we get as well. Maybe first of all, talk to me a little bit about the input of Newell Tsumbo, if you would tell me about that, Francesco.
Yeah, Newell is an amazing guitarist from Congo that has been living in Ireland for a long time. And I'd worked with him a good few times before. I think he's a very unique musician because his music is also very hard to define. And, you know, he flirts with jazz, and there's, of course, a very strong Congolese sound. He's worked a lot with trad musicians. So, you know, when we thought about who could we have, you know, that could work with our sounds, I thought almost immediately about him as an option, you know. Mm. And it worked. I mean, what he brings to the album, we think, is amazing. We didn't really know it was going to work this well. And it's very, very special. And he was literally like on the spot. He didn't even know what he was coming to play. So it was quite amazing.
Yeah, there's a feel of that on the track, one particular track that he features on quite heavily, Newell Goes to Town. It's like a two guitar answer and response. I presume that was the two of you having a little bit of guitar chat, was it?
No, at the very beginning, it's Rhiannon actually with the gourd banjo. It's very interesting because, you know, Rhiannon was playing the gourd banjo, and, you know, which is obviously an instrument that ties very much to his African ancestors. And Newell is playing the Western nylon string guitar, and they're talking to each other, and it makes so much sense. It's incredible.
Yeah, that'll teach. I'm never going to guess any instrument on any album you play on again, because I will not know what the instrument is or who's playing it. And the other artist that I think is vitally important to the album is Emer Mayock, flautist and Illan pipe player. She's there on a great track called Black as Crow, this lovely waltz time where she comes in with a flute along the way, and there's a real Irish feel to a track called Bully for You, a purely instrumental track. Again, I think it's flute that she has on that one, if I remember right. But the very final track on the album is quite extraordinary, your version of Amazing Grace. Tell me a little bit about how you give us none of the words here. How did this arrangement come into being, Rhiannon?
Well, it's an interesting mixture of things. You know, at one point when Francesco and I were kind of messing around, you know, and sort of playing different things, and he started this sort of pulse. I mean, it wasn't a groove, but it was like a, you know, his frame drums all have a tone. So it was kind of a rhythmic drone that didn't have a set groove to it. And he said, you know, could you sing something over this? And the first thing that came to my mind was a humming Amazing Grace. We just love the sound of it. And as we were putting this record together and thinking about what to do, that piece, you know, that arrangement kind of came back. And I had kind of you know, hummed it in a way that kind of recalled me to all the times I've heard Amazing Grace played on bagpipes at funerals, you know, in the States. It's a thing. And the just the tone and the shape of the notes, that's how I was, you know, approaching it. And so when Emer came onto the project, I was like, well, she plays pipes, like, let's get it all together and see what happens. And you know, the experience of being in one room, we didn't have any isolation for any of this. You know, we were in one room, I'm humming, Francesco's playing the frame drum, and Emer's playing her pipes. And like the sensation of singing with her when her pipes come in, and like feeling the molecules of our two sounds sort of melding, you know, with Francesco's sounds, was just, it was really a spectacular moment.
Mayock on Illan Pipes there in that version of Amazing Grace from Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Terese, and that is from their album They're Calling Me Home. 12 absolutely magical tracks. I can't recommend it highly enough. Coming up shortly, we'll speak with anthropologist Henry Glassie. Pat Collins' most recent film, Henry Glassie Fieldwork, follows celebrated folklorist and anthropologist Henry Glassie on his latest research project studying folk art and cultural production in Brazil. Glassie's work involves total immersion in the culture of the community he chooses to study. Previously, he's lived with ceramicists and rug makers in Turkey, and in the 1970s, he spent 11 years in the border community of Ballymanone in County Fermanagh. His fieldwork there produced 5 books, including All Silver and No Brass and Passing the Time in Ballymanone. I'm absolutely delighted to be joined on the programme this evening by Henry Glassie. Henry, this film of Pat Collins, it opens with you. You make a short statement that you make to camera, if you like, and then for 1.5 hour with absolutely no words, we just watch several artists in Brazil, sculptors, printmakers, and we watch them making the pieces of art that they make without comment, without guide. Their names appear on screen as we go from one to the next. But it really struck me that opening half hour of the film by Pat Collins is an exact mirror of the way you work yourself in how you go about looking at these communities and the people within them.
That's certainly an accurate observation by you. I think that Pat captured me perfectly by leaving me out of the film. The film is wonderful. I can tell you that one of the glorious things in my life has been working with Pat Collins. The man is patient. He's a great artist. And it was just terrific to work with Pat. And his vision was to follow my vision for us to go together, which we did through the backcountry of Brazil, and for him to capture just beautiful, beautiful footage of the artists that I love, working hard, being excellent, being artists. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience to work with Pat. And I have to say, because we're just here, that you've already provided me with a terrific seg, because you've just given me all the songs from my childhood. I mean, Sunday school singing Amazing Grace, and you've got, for heaven's sakes, the great Doc Boggs' version of O Death.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all familiar stuff. So you started me with my childhood, and now you're launching me into maturity with my time with Pat. But I'm telling you that Pat and I have become dear friends as a result of being good colleagues. Mm. And Pat's patience and Pat's artistry were a wonderful part of my life experience.
Well, I'm sure he would say immediately he can only do that because he's reflecting what you do yourself. But you mentioned your childhood there, and let's go right back there and how lucky you were in that childhood in two aspects of your grandparents, your grandmother and her great love of history, and your grandfather and his great ability with wood.
Well, you're absolutely right. for my grandmother provided me with an interest in history, and it was probably an interest in history that brought me ultimately to Ireland. But at the same time, my grandfather was a master of mystery. He was unbelievable that he could turn a wrecked old tree into a beautiful table. And so that mystery of watching him work has guided me from the very beginning to the end. But it's also true that my grandmother knew exactly the kind of songs that were just featured, 15 minutes ago in your show. And so that what it's like I say, it's like old time. Coming back to Amazing Grace is just a beautiful experience for me.
Yeah, well, the title of that album, "They're Calling Me Home," you know, in some ways is what that music must do for you. And it was music, in fact, and the music of the Southern States of the United States of America. It was music that was your initial interest, or certainly your initial route into what you did, I think.
Well, that's exactly right. I considered myself to be a Southern child, and as a Southern child, there was something that I had to be proud of, and I couldn't be proud of the deep history, but I could be very proud of the qualities of the music. And one of the things that I thought of as a small child is I belonged to a place where people were farmers, people were poor, people were black, and people were white. They got along well together, and one of the things that brought them together was a tremendous high quality of the music. It was a normal part of my childhood experience. My great uncle was a champion fiddler. And so I was raised with that music. And when I got old enough to do something serious with my life, I headed up into the mountains, and it was very easy to find those great old musicians. They were still going, Hobart Smith and wonderful musicians. But I also found the whole landscape to be exciting. I found the whole experience. I liked the architecture. I liked the woodwork. I liked the quilts. I liked the people. And that launched me on an experience of taking that kind of a desire to be immersed in a place initially slightly foreign, and then places that became more and more foreign. And I'd always wanted to go to Ireland in particular, not out of some kind of genealogical connection, but rather out of an absolute astonishment with the qualities of Irish literature.
And what specifically brought you to Ballymanone in County Fermanagh, Henry?
Well, nothing brought me particularly there. What I did was, when I finally was able to travel, I hadn't traveled much in my life. When I finally got a grant that would allow me to do what I wanted to do, which was serious field work at great length, I really wanted to work hard in a single place, and I chose Ireland because of the literature, and I chose Ballymanone for the very simple reason that the landscape was beautiful. I drove along the border, and in driving along the border, I was looking for a place where I could spend time, long time, with people who were in the midst of serious trouble. Talking about 1972, the bloodiest year of the Troubles. But what I did was I settled in a place that was just beautiful. Not beautiful because of great natural landscape, but beautiful because the people loved their land. They took care of it. The hedges were hacked back. The fields were neat. The houses were whitewashed and thatched. The landscape was beautiful. And I just walked into that place because I said anybody felt down inside. Anybody who cared that much for the land, who cared that much for God's gift, would be kind to a strange traveling guy like me who wanted to not merely meet them, but spend time with them, ultimately live with them, write about them, and get an understanding of how regular people endure through hard times. That was my goal.
Let's listen to one of the people that you met. You met all 153 inhabitants, I think, of the particular place. But let's listen to one of those men, a man called Peter Flanagan.
They wouldn't touch you, Pauline. They wouldn't touch you. You're a foreigner. It's all Irish.
I never thought, what would they do with the children?
Huh?
What would they do with the children?
Well, they say they have the greatest time in the world with the fairies. Uh-huh. I hear tell of one coming back and said that she would not come back. And only think, 100 years is only like a day in fairyland. Uh-huh. Or maybe 1,000 years is only like a day.
Is that true?
That's as true, Pauline, as I got it, really. That's the tradition of the country. The assembly every night from one house to another, I went to your house and you went to my house, and we sat down and we told fairy tales like that. And it seemed to me that it was definitely true.
What an absolutely beautiful clip there, the voice of Peter Flanagan. And that comes from the film we're speaking about this evening, Henry Glassy Fieldwork, Pat Collins film, but it's Henry Glassy that's speaking to me. Who was the little girl that we heard in the midst of that clip, Henry?
Well, that was my oldest daughter, whose name is Polly. And when I went to Ballymanone, I didn't go alone. I went with my wife and three children, and we settled down in a very inexpensive caravan in that place. And ultimately, or let's say at the very beginning, I met Peter Flanagan on the very first day that I was walking around Ballymanone, and ultimately I lived with Peter and became deeply fond of Peter. He was one of the great, he was a great fiddler. He was a great musician. I mean, genuinely great musician. His father, Phil, was a great musician. And Peter became a dear, dear friend. And that would happen to be a story that he was telling about fairies at the at his hearth on the Bridge of Drumbargy in Ballymanone. And he told that story, and my daughter was shocked, frightened by it, asked if it was true, and he gave a wonderful answer.
Of course it's true. It's about the little people. It's about the fairies. And it, but it does bring up something, Henry, that I think is very interesting in terms of the way you think about history, if we can use that word. Peter says in the midst of all of that, oh, in fairyland, a day could be 100 years or it could be 1,000 years, because time is not important. And you talk about this and the people, the historians in that particular part of the country, you say how time wasn't their guiding light when it came to telling history. Place was their guiding light.
Well, I think that's a very Irish trait and a very useful trait, because what time does is it alienates you from the past. Time's passing, chronology, prevents you from feeling a connection to the things that are in from the past. But if the past is happening, which was the Ballymanone view, if the past is perpetually happening on the land, in place, then when you walk over the bridge at Drumain, you understand that you're walking over a river where long ago, as 1594, there was a great battle fought. And that battle doesn't then become something from the 16th century. It becomes a part of your daily life, a part of your experience of the world. Mm. And all of those historic messages become compelling, a part of your daily life.
Let me ask you about your time in Turkey, because it really struck me in the film what we see there are these amazing rugs that we see being made and amazing ceramic works that we see being made in front of our eyes. That kind of abstract art, you speak very interestingly how that kind of abstraction is made by people who, on the surface of it, you would think, well, they're not going to make something like that. They're going to make something figurative. Just explain that abstraction a little bit further to me, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, I think it's not very difficult. I think that we have, that is, we in the West have a tendency towards the figurative, precisely because we're told that man was made in God's image. That's not a holding among Muslims. Instead, there the vision is that God is not represented in a body. There's no God who's going to create Adam on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Instead, God is a force, is an abstract force, is an embracing force, is a drive through the universe. And the way to represent that is through beautiful symmetrical design. And so those beautiful symmetrical designs that appear on plates, that appear on rugs, are really, in some senses, tremendously modern because they're abstract, but they're also tremendously ancient because they are carriers of a particular vision of the sacred, a vision of the sacred that avoids the body and features the spirit, and the spirit is the universal spirit of God who has created the perfect world that we're lucky enough to inhabit.
Henry, it's fascinating to speak with you, and it's fascinating also to see what you give to us via Pat Collins in the film. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Well, it was a delight, and it was exciting to hear the music and exciting to talk with you. And I think that anybody would go and see Pat's film would see that that's a masterwork by a great artist having something to do with me, but mostly to do with Pat, a wonderful man.
Henry Glassy, how generous of you to be so kind in your words there to Pat Collins. And the film that Henry was speaking to us about is called Henry Glassy Fieldwork. It opens on Gate Cinemas Online, IFI at Home, QFT Online and the Volta platforms. And that's another hour and 45 minutes of your life that will be well spent if you get a chance to watch it. That is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields Research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was in sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RTÉ Radio 1.